So my name is Pastor Ben. I'm one of the pastors here, and I'm so excited to be here talking about this book, Life Together. Anybody read this? Mike's been pushing it last month. We keep getting it in the bookstore, and it keeps selling out. And I have to say, this is a book that completely changed my life. I read it when I was discerning my call to go back to the ministry. It's one of those things that really wrecked me and really helped me see that I couldn't run from my call anymore. And I just picked it up. I was like, oh, I've heard of that guy, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And I picked that up at a Christian bookstore, not knowing the bomb that was between these covers in these pages. And it completely changed my life, and it turned me upside down. And so for that reason, I really want to encourage you to read it. It's pretty, really deep stuff, but really worthwhile. And Mike said this morning, and I believe it's true, that Bonhoeffer saved the best for last. We're going to talk about communion tonight, and obviously it makes real sense because we're sharing communion and having that together and celebrating that. But also, as I was thinking about it this week, everything you see out there, this mess that we have going here, this holy, beautiful mess that we have in our hallways here is an extension of that communion. You might not realize this, looking at what we celebrate here, but this is something that in the early church resembled that just as much as it resembled this. They would gather for a meal every week together as the church. And the Christian church at the time appealed a lot to orphans and widows and people that were poor and people that were slaves. And so sharing a meal together was something that was really important, not only just for the spiritual aspect, but also for providing for those who are in need within the church. And so it served both purposes, and it was this really, really beautiful thing. So as we gather here, I love the fact that this holiday that we celebrate as a nation, the Super Bowl, kind of becomes this religious holiday here at Hope. Isn't that a beautiful thing? You know, when I grew up in the Lutheran church, we had Ash Wednesday and Pentecost and Reformation Sunday, which I always remember because my dad was a worship leader, and he had these red pants that he would put on that were just tremendously awkward. But we'd always wear red for Reformation Sunday. So every year, just that day, he would get out his red pants. But then you have the secular holidays like Super Bowl Sunday. It's a miraculous thing. Those things get intertwined. And so there's a guy on Twitter, he's called the Church Curmudgeon, and he posted this on Twitter. So I think this is true. You should be as excited about church as you are about the Super Bowl. When your pastor makes a point this Sunday, pour Gatorade over his head, he says. Now, I was hesitant to share that because I know there might be some Gatorade out there in the hallway. So I'm not saying do that, but I think the point should be taken. We should be really excited about this thing that God is doing here, and this thing that God is doing here, because it's really nothing less than miraculous. It really is. And as Jesus comes to be with his disciples in what we now call his Last Supper, this is what he was coming to tell them. The God who is doing this miraculous thing. And the translation that we have says, I have been very eager to eat this Passover meal. And the Greek is something more like, I've desired this great desire to share this meal with you. And it's this emphatic expression of, my heart has been beating for this. I really, really want to share this with you. And this is tremendously important for us right now to experience. Not just because they always do it, and it's a tradition, and you do it because you've always done it, but because this meal is this meal of remembrance, of remembering the things God has done. And by remembering the things God has done, we can trust and have hope in what God is going to do now. I want you to say that with me. Say, remember what God has done so you can trust what God is doing. Remember what God has done so you can trust what God is doing. So much of reading this book is about that. And the way they celebrated Passover was this meal of remembrance of the things God had done in delivering his people from Egypt. not just because remembering is important, but because it changed the way they lived the reality they were in at the time. It changed the way they interacted with each other. It changed the reality of their brokenness. It changed the reality of their suffering and their oppression to know that God is the God that delivers. And they trusted God, and they had hope in God to deliver them now. And this night, above all nights, in this time where the Israelite people were so oppressed, the people that lived in Judea were under the thumb of the Romans in such a horrible way, and Jesus himself was in danger of getting arrested and persecuted and killed at any moment. And he says this, "I have desired this great desire to share this with you." I want you to realize this is because this is something that Jesus needs for himself. He needs to hear this. He needs to hear the story so that he can hear the things that God has done and know that God is doing the same, because God never changes. That the God that delivered in the past is the God that delivers now. That in the midst of his suffering, he needed to hear the deliverance of God. I want you to resonate with that so that you can know in the midst of your suffering, you also need to hear the deliverance of God. You need to hear that our God is a God that delivers. And Jesus is reframing that. And we hear it every time we celebrate communion, but we hear it again in this text. He says, when you eat this, this meal of remembrance of the past and the exodus from Egypt, I want you to remember me. And the way that he says remember me doesn't mean it's just a memorial meal or just that it's a symbol, but he means that he's changing the meaning so that it's not just about what God did in the past, but it's also about what God is doing now. And it's what God is doing now in this hallway as we gather all this food. It's about God is doing now in your hearts as you hear these words. And it's what God is doing now in my heart as I prepare to preach this and as I stand in front of you. God is on the move right now. God is trying to speak that to you, and Jesus is trying to speak that to his disciples. And he's trying to help them understand the gravity of what's going on. And he's trying to help them see that in spite of their sin, God is doing something great, and there's nothing, not even the devil himself can come against it, but the devil is throwing everything he can at it. So Jesus tells them, one of you is going to betray me. And they have this amazing way of changing the subject. And when we read the Bible sometimes in the church, we kind of break them up into pericopes. We say, all right, we're going to read verse 14, 15, 16, 17, and then we're going to stop. And then we're just going to focus on those things. And then we miss the flow of the whole story. So the way that this story flows into the next story is important. So at the end of our reading, it talks about how the Son of Man must die, but the sorrow... And he's pouring out his life as a sacrifice. And he says, but here at this table, sitting amongst us as a friend, is the man who will betray me. For this has been determined that the Son of Man must die. But what sorrow awaits the one who betrays him? The disciples began to ask each other, which of them would do such a thing? And then that's kind of where we stop sometimes. And then the next thing says, they began to argue amongst themselves about who would be the greatest among them. And I said, I read this time as I was preparing for the sermon. It hit me in a different way. Isn't it amazing that Jesus says, you're going to betray me? And like, oh, okay, well, so who do you think the greatest is? Because, you know, my name's Simon Peter, and I'm in all the stories that you really see in the Bible, so obviously it's not me. And so then they start arguing amongst themselves, but I see this thing that we do in our lives where we have this amazing propensity to kind of deflect and kind of divert the conversation and kind of push the attention away from the thing that we're being convicted about. Because they, even in the way that it bears out later, as things come to fruition, as they know that Judas is the one that he's talking about, there's not one of them that can point at Judas and say, well, at least that wasn't me, because none of them get out of it totally clean. But here we are trying to defend ourselves. And the way that God points out our brokenness so many times, God sees our broken hearts. And there are times in our lives when he shares a mirror with us. And he through a friend or through something we experience, he shows us. Jesus gives us a glimpse. He doesn't tell us the whole thing because we couldn't bear it. But he shows us the depth of our brokenness in a deeper way. And so just like the disciples, when Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me, we divert it to something else. And you see that throughout the Bible as you see all these religious leaders, they kind of figure out a way to cover it up. And they wear a mask. Whether it's their religiosity or their whatever the thing that they really claim to be their own, their status, their power. We figure out a way to put a mask over this to kind of cover up our broken heart. And you see that, the way they say, oh, betrayal, well, who's the greatest? So what are the ways that we divert our attention from that? Bonhoeffer, in his chapter on communion, rightly focuses more on confession than he does communion. Because communion, this idea that we're together, that you're unified, that we're unified with God, unified with each other, is wholly dependent on our ability and our willingness to be real. There's this sense that we keep everybody at arm's length because we're not able to even face for ourselves what the truth of who we are really is. And if we're not willing to face the truth of who we are, how can we share that with anybody else? So Bonhoeffer, as he talks about confession, go to the next slide, please. It says, the one who is alone with his or her sin is utterly alone. Right? But that's what this leaves us. Right? We can't really be anything but alone when this mask that we wear is all that anybody ever gets to know. With God, we wear this mask. With our family, we wear this mask. With our loved ones, with the strangers on the street, with our coworkers, with our pastors. I see you. We have this way of wearing this mask so that we really don't have to be ourselves, because there's this insecurity here. There's this sense that who I am just isn't enough. And I'm just not going to measure up. When I was in high school, I was trying to answer the question that everybody asks high schoolers always. What do you want to be when you grow up? And I had no idea whatsoever. And I come to this place in my life where I'm trying to wrestle with this thing. And I really love music. And I've been playing guitar since I was 17, not very long. But I knew that I wanted to make it a big part of my life. And so I'm thinking, well, I'll just go study music. And I'm trying to work out, like, how am I going to make this work? And I'd never played classical music at all. And I know that if you go to college for music, it's usually classical music. But I knew that University of Northern Colorado, which was about 40 minutes from my house, had a great jazz program, so I'm thinking I'm going to go study jazz guitar. And I didn't have a lot of money, and I wanted to practice some more. So I went to community college, got my associate of arts, got all my general ed out of the way, and then I'm going to go and enroll at University of Northern Colorado. So it's like this watershed moment in my life where I'm going to come to this brink of where I have to take this jump into this music program and audition and put myself out there. And it was terrifying. It was terrifying just to email the professor. And I told him a little bit about myself, how long I've been playing, just really cursory stuff, asked him what I needed to do. He responds by telling me, you need to learn all these, you need to play this and that, these etudes. And I'm like, I don't even know what that is. I never heard of that. And then, so he says, and I tell him, I'm more interested in learning jazz than I am classical. Obviously, I'm not disinterested in classical, but I really want to make that my focus. And he's like, well, I don't really play jazz, and I don't teach jazz, so this probably isn't the thing for you. And I really don't take very many students, so that's kind of where it's at. And so I just left it there. I just ended it. And I live with this insecurity that kind of, I let myself be cut off from trying because I was afraid of being found out as inadequate. I have this fear of being found out as inadequate. I have this fear that somebody's going to peek under my mask, right? That somebody's going to see what really is under there. And this facade that I'm showing everybody is just going to come falling away. And so I'm in this space where, now what do I tell people? So I devise a clever lie that kind of gets me away from having to admit that I'm too afraid to really audition. And I tell people, well, I don't want to be a teacher, and that's true, so I might as well not audition. And the professor was really a jerk, and it's just not for me. And so it's that fear of inadequacy, that fear of failing, ends up being the thing that keeps me from being anything, really. And so I'm kind of at a place in my life where I just drop out of school and then ask my now wife's dad for her hand in marriage. And let me tell you, that's not the best plan ever. Hey, I just dropped out. Can I marry your daughter? There's no father-in-law on the planet that wants to hear it that way. But this in that moment, I didn't realize it now, but as I look back, I was able to see the ways that fear of inadequacy has been a driving factor in my life. And it's about taking that mask off. And this fear of failure and fear of inadequacy is something that has kind of dictated my relationships and my career path and this sense of who I am and how I understand my identity. And so that mask is really the thing that has been killing me and killing any chance that I have to really live into God's calling for me. There's this sense that because we're dishonest with ourselves, we really can't grow. And so I'm going to show you a little clip. It's just kind of silly, but it really hammers home, you'll get the pun in a minute, hammers home this idea that the mask that we wear, the inability to acknowledge what is really going on in our lives is the thing that's really holding us back. Maybe there's people in your life, maybe you're a person, there's some difficult thing in your life where you just say, we don't talk about that. Is there a secret in your family, something you just don't talk about, just so you can get by? There's a psalm we're going to look at it deeper in a minute, but it says, what joy for those whose record the Lord has cleared of guilt, whose lives are lived in complete honesty. You see, Jesus says the truth will set us free. There's this sense that that confessing our sins to God, but also confessing them to somebody else is this huge path toward healing and grace and receiving the love of God in a way that we never could otherwise and believing and having certainty in those things. Now, who thinks joy goes with confessing your sins? When I say, yeah, great. So when I think, confessing your sins and I say joy, you're like, yeah, those two things go together. So all the people who raise your hand, you're first. And so we're gonna get a microphone up here. No, I'm just kidding. So we don't necessarily associate those things. But in confessing our sins and being vulnerable and opening ourselves to other people, we realize joy. We realize this certainty that we have in the gospel because we lay it all out there. If I hold something back, I always have this sense of doubt that there's something about me that you would reject, that God would reject. And I always have fear that that's going to happen, and that's why I hold it back. But if I lay it out there and I'm not rejected, if I lay it out there and God says, you're my beloved child and I love you, then I have this peace. I have this joy. I have this thing that the world can never take away from me. It's amazing. And so this honesty that comes so unnaturally to us, that we struggle so much to have, is this freeing thing that really is tragically something that's so far from who we are because we're wearing these masks. And honesty is something my 3-year-old daughter up here in the front row is really teaching me. here's this note, not from her, from another kid to her teacher. It says, "Dear Miss McMahon, you're a good teacher, but you're not my most favorite." And then this next teacher to a mom, or this next note to a mom, "Thank you, Mom, for being wonderful and caring and not making your meatloaf anymore." So my daughter yesterday comes down the stairs from we didn't realize was our bedroom, and she walks up to Mom with this great big grin and says, "Mom, look! I put your chapstick on my piggies." So I learned the honesty of children is this thing that I need to embrace, but also never to borrow my wife's chapstick because it's been on my daughter's toes. but this honesty is something that we really, really need, this thing that it will really set us free from this thing that's holding us back, from this mask that we put there to protect ourselves, to keep us safe, but is really the only thing that's keeping us unsafe. This sense that in confession, sin that is concealed separates us from true fellowship. It separates us from being real with ourselves and knowing who we really are. And it separates us from other people. Sin confessed opens us up to true fellowship. It opens us up to this reality, this sense that there's something greater going on. There's a sense that I could be more than I ever realized if I just let go of my fears. I love that song that Mike was singing before about being sheltered in the eye of the storm and clinging to the love that God has sworn for us. That's what it's about right there. That's this thing that God is talking about. I had no idea what he was singing about. You see the way that God weaves it all together, this miracle of the way that God speaks. And we've all felt that here where, you know, I don't know how many times I've heard people talk about Pastor Mike, and they're like, "Well, he's speaking right at me." That's God speaking right at you. It's not Pastor Mike. There's this great show that I really like called This Is Us. Anybody watch that show? Yeah. You can tell people are like, yeah, they're really excited about it. It's this really great show that just follows the life of a family. And this married couple end up having triplets, and they lose one, and then they adopt a baby at the hospital that was born that same day and coincidentally was dropped off at a fire station. And then they just see it as meant to be that this baby was born the same day as their triplets. When they lost one of their babies due to complications in birth, this other baby just shows up and doesn't have anybody. So they adopt this child. His name's Randall. That's him right here. And Randall obviously is African-American, and his family is white. And so there's all these different plot twists and complications that happen because of this, because they can't really understand his perspective. They can't really understand where he's coming from fully because they just have a different experience than he does. And this is a great plug for that one church thing we were talking about earlier. The sense that we need to listen to each other and we need to try to understand where people are coming from as best we can, but also recognize that we only see things through our perspective. And so that listening becomes so important because only then can they tell us what really is going on. So Randall struggles with his identity as a black man and a black boy, and what that means for his family when he is different in a lot of different ways, and he's treated different in public. He's treated different by his brother, he thinks, because of his race. And this sense that who am I? You know, and when we live with this mask that's really covering our broken heart, then who am I is this question that's so far out of our reach. But Randall is pursuing it. He's looking for ways to answer this question, even as a young boy. Throughout the show, you see different ways that he tries to live it out. And this causes great anxiety in his mom. His mom is really worried that she's not going to be enough for Randall. She worries a lot about Randall fitting in. She worries about him not being looked down on. She worries about him having every opportunity that her other kids have. And so she overcompensates. As one of the other characters, one of Randall's brother says, Mom was so focused on trying to make sure you didn't feel too adopted. And so Randall is going through this searching as a boy, and his dad takes him to this karate dojo so that he can have an African-American role model to look up to and kind of learn who he could possibly be when he grows up in a different way than he could from his dad. And it's not that his dad is bad. He's this wonderful father, but he's insufficient. He's not everything Randall needs. And we struggle with that as parents. And I do. As I look at my kids here, I think, I want to be everything that my kids need. But in reality, if we're trying to play that role in somebody else's life, we're trying to play a role that only God can play. So here you see Randall in this place where his dad is doing a good job of trying to make sure that he has other influence from other adults that he can learn something from that he can't learn from his parents. But you see this great insecurity from his mom, and it creates this great tension. And Randall doesn't know this, but his mom actually met his biological father shortly after his birthday, when he was born. And so she knew who he was and where he was and why he dropped Randall off for years and years and years, but never shared with Randall because of that insecurity, because it was her mask, it was her shield, it was the thing that was protecting her from her broken heart, from the fear of having Randall leave the family. So this shield is the thing that she is thinking is protecting her, but ends up being the thing that is the barrier in relationship. When I refused to confess my sin, my body wasted away, Psalm 32 says. I groaned all day long. You see the way this tears apart this family. So Randall is in this place where, as an adult, he finds out that mom knew his dad all along for 36 years and didn't share that with him. And she says to her husband, we need to be enough for him. We need to be enough. We need to be. And this amazing thing that happens because we're willing to take off our mask, because we're willing to say that we aren't enough. You see, the answer isn't to somehow discover or become enough. The answer is to realize that I'm not enough, that I am inadequate, that I am insufficient in some ways, that I am a sinner, that I'm broken, that I'm flawed, and that I'm lost. And these, recognizing these things are the things that will keep us alive, these things. And in these things, we die. We die to ourselves when we recognize that in all these things, we fall short. We fall short of the glory of God. We should fall short of the things that we want to be for ourselves. We fall short of our dreams for ourselves. But that is the first thing that we need to recognize if we're ever going to get better. You can't get a cure unless you realize that you're sick. And so let church be a place where we can be sinners together. And God forbid that any church be anything less. This is a pretty exclusive group. You have to be a sinner to be here. And if you're not a sinner, get out, because you're ruining it for everybody else. And Bonhoeffer talks about that. He doesn't pull his punches. He says, the pious fellowship permits that no one be a sinner. So everyone must conceal his sin from himself and from the fellowship. We dare not be sinners. Many Christians are unthinkably horrified when a real sinner is suddenly discovered among the righteous. So we remain alone with our sin, living in lies and hypocrisy. The fact is, we are sinners. I think he's right. We are horrified when we realize that somebody else is a sinner. But in another way, we're honestly relieved. We have this sense, well, you know, at least I can say now that I'm not as bad as that guy. But we need to dare to be a sinner. And he mentions earlier, we need to be dare to be the chief of sinners. And in all these things, we can acknowledge these things. We can acknowledge our broken heart. And we can come to realize that being a Christian means being both these things at the same time. It means, even though I am insufficient, Christ makes me enough. Even though I'm a sinner, Christ makes me a saint. Even though I'm broken, Christ makes me healed. Even though I'm flawed, Jesus Christ makes me beautiful. Even though I'm lost, I'm found. And in this sense, God takes our broken heart and he undoes it. He takes these things and he nails them to the cross so that we don't have to bear those things anymore. He heals our broken heart in the way that only God can. And this is the God of death and resurrection that we serve. We die to all these other things so that we can live for Christ, so that we can live in adequacy. We can live as saints. We can live healed and beautiful and found. And as we share this meal, that's what this is about. This is about God being enough for you. Just like Rebecca in the show says, we have to be enough. You have to recognize that you're not enough. That's why confession is so important. And when you admit it to somebody else, it clears the air. A Christian in the fellowship of confession will never, ever be alone again anywhere. Isn't that a beautiful statement? Are you lonely? Are you afraid? Are you bearing something, the weight of which you don't know if you can carry? Confess your sins. Open your heart. Let this be a place where you can be yourself and entrust your heart to God so that God can cleanse you. God can heal your broken heart and make you enough. So as we close tonight, what we're going to do is read through a psalm. It's Psalm 32, and the psalms are really great for these things because they are prayers to God, and they also teach us how to live what God has called us to live. So this psalm is a psalm that is a confession. It teaches us how to confess. That's the Lord's Prayer. We're not doing that. Do you have the slides with the psalm? They're a little bit of tech, or I'll just read it. How about that? I was thinking we could read this together, but I want you to hear this. And I want you to hear these words, and then we're going to pause for a time of confession. And then we're going to read a little bit further in the psalm. But this is Psalm 32. Oh, what joy for those whose disobedience is forgiven, whose sin is put out of sight. Yes, what joy for those whose record the Lord has cleared of guilt, whose lives are lived in complete honesty. When I refused to confess my sin, my body wasted away, and I groaned all day long. Day and night, your hand of discipline was heavy on me. My strength evaporated like water in the summer heat. And the psalmist continues, finally, I confessed all my sins to you, and I stopped trying to hide my guilt. I said to myself, I will confess my rebellion to the Lord, and you forgave me. All my guilt is gone. Therefore, let all the godly pray to you while there is still time, that they may not drown in the floodwaters of judgment. For you are my hiding place. You protect me from trouble. You surround me with songs of victory.